Chapter 68. And therefore much more healthily. It might be far more healthy than it is, but there are some people in it still even now, at this time, nearly 200 years later, so selfish, so pig-headed, and so ignorant, that I doubt if even another great fire would warm them up to do their duty. The Catholics were accused of having willfully set London in flames. One poor Frenchman, who had been mad for years, even accused himself of having with his own hand fired the first house. There is no reasonable doubt, however, that the fire was accidental. An inscription on the monument long attributed it to the Catholics, but it is removed now, and was always a malicious and stupid untruth. Second part, that the merry monarch might be very merry indeed, in the merry times, when his people were suffering under pestilence and fire, he drank and gambled and flung away among his favorites the money which the Parliament had voted for the war. The consequence of this was that the stout-hearted English sailors were merrily starving of want, and dying in the streets, while the Dutch, under their admirals De Witt and De Ruyter, came into the River Thames, and up the River Medway as far as up Nore, burned the guard ships, silenced the weak batteries, and did what they would to the English coast for 6 whole weeks. Most of the English ships that could have prevented them had neither powder nor shot on board. In this merry reign, public officers made themselves as merry as the king did with the public money. And when it was entrusted to them to spend in national defenses or preparations, they put it into their own pockets with the merriest grace in the world. Lord Clarendon had, by this time, run as long a course as is usually allotted to the unscrupulous ministers of bad kings. He was impeached by his political opponents, but unsuccessfully. The king then commanded him to withdraw from England and retire to France, which he did, after defending himself in writing. He was no great loss at home, and died abroad some 7 years afterwards. There then came into power a ministry called the Cabal Ministry, because it was composed of Lord Clifford, the Earl of Arlington, the Duke of Buckingham, a great rascal, and the king's most powerful favorite, Lord Ashley, and the Duke of Lauderdale, C.A.B.A. 50. As the French were making conquests in Flanders, the first cabal proceeding was to make a treaty with the Dutch, for uniting with Spain to oppose the French. It was no sooner made than the merry monarch, who always wanted to get money without being accountable to a parliament for his expenditure, apologized to the King of France for having had anything to do with it, and concluded a secret treaty with him, making himself his infamous pensioner to the amount of 2 millions of livres down, and 3 millions more a year, and engaging to desert that very Spain, to make war against those very Dutch, and to declare himself a Catholic, when a convenient time should arrive. This religious king had lately been crying to his Catholic brother on the subject of his strong desire to be a Catholic, and now he merrily concluded this treasonable conspiracy against the country he governed, by undertaking to become one, as soon as he safely could. For all of which, though he had had 10 merry heads instead of one, he richly deserved to lose them by the headsman's axe. As his one merry head might have been far from safe, if these things had been known, they were kept very quiet, and war was declared by France and England against the Dutch. But, a very uncommon man, afterwards most important to English history, and to the religion and liberty of this land, arose among them, and for many long years defeated the whole projects of France. This was William of Nassau, Prince of Orange, son of the last Prince of Orange of the same name, who married the daughter of Charles I of England. He was a young man at this time, only just of age, but he was brave, cool, intrepid, and wise. His father had been so detested that, upon his death, the Dutch had abolished the authority to which this son would have otherwise succeeded, Stadtholder it was called, and placed the chief power in the hands of John de Witt, who educated this young prince. Now, the prince became very popular, and John DeWitt's brother Cornelius was sentenced to banishment on a false accusation of conspiring to kill him. John went to the prison where he was, to take him away to exile, in his coach, and a great mob who collected on the occasion, then and there cruelly murdered both the brothers. This left the government in the hands of the prince, who was really the choice of the nation, and from this time he exercised it with the greatest vigor, against the whole power of France, under its famous generals Conde and Turenne, and in support of the Protestant religion. It was full 7 years before this war ended in a treaty of peace made at Nimeguen, and its details would occupy a very considerable space. It is enough to say that William of Orange established a famous character with the whole world, and that the Merry Monarch, adding to and improving on his former baseness, bound himself to do everything the King of France liked, and nothing the King of France did not like, for a pension of £100,000 a year, which was afterwards doubled. Besides this, the King of France, by means of his corrupt ambassador who wrote accounts of his proceedings in England, which are not always to be believed, I think bought our English members of Parliament, as he wanted them. So, in point of fact, during a considerable portion of this merry reign, the King of France was the real king of this country. But there was a better time to come, and it was to come, though his royal uncle little thought so, through that very William, Prince of Orange. He came over to England, saw Mary, the elder daughter of the Duke of York, and married her. We shall see by and by what came of that marriage, and why it is never to be forgotten. This daughter was a Protestant, but her mother died a Catholic. She and her sister Anne, also a Protestant, were the only survivors of 8 children. Anne afterwards married George, Prince of Denmark, brother to the king of that country. Lest you should do the Merry Monarch the injustice of supposing that he was even good-humored except when he had everything his own way, or that he was high-spirited and honorable, I will mention here what was done to a member of the House of Commons, Sir John Coventry. He made a remark in a debate about taxing the theaters, which gave the king offense. The king agreed with his illegitimate son, who had been born abroad, and whom he had made Duke of Monmouth, to take the following merry vengeance: to waylay him at night, 15 armed men to 1, and to slit his nose with a penknife. Like master, like man. The king's favorite, the Duke of Buckingham, was strongly suspected of setting on an assassin, to murder the Duke of Ormond as he was returning home from a dinner. And that duke's spirited son, Lord Ossory, was so persuaded of his guilt, that he said to him at court, even as he stood beside the king, "My lord, I know very well, that you are at the bottom of this late attempt upon my father. But I give you warning, if he ever come to a violent end, his blood shall be upon you, and wherever I meet you, I will pistol you. I will do so, though I find you standing behind the king's chair. And I tell you this in His Majesty's presence, that you may be quite sure of my doing what I threaten." Those were merry times indeed. There was a fellow named Blood, who was seized for making, with 2 companions, an audacious attempt to steal the crown, the globe, and scepter, from the place where the jewels were kept in the tower. This robber, who was a swaggering ruffian, being taken, declared that he was the man who had endeavored to kill the Duke of Ormond, and that he had meant to kill the king too, but was overawed by the majesty of his appearance, when he might otherwise have done it, as he was bathing at Battersea. "The king being but an ill-looking fellow, I don't believe a word of this." Whether he was flattered, or whether he knew that Buckingham had really set Blood on to murder the Duke, is uncertain. But it is quite certain that he pardoned this thief, gave him an estate of 500 a year in Ireland which had had the honor of giving him birth, and presented him at court to the debauched lords and the shameless ladies, who made a great deal of him as I have no doubt they would have made of the devil himself, if the king had introduced him. Infamously pensioned as he was, the king still wanted money, and consequently was obliged to call parliaments. In these, the great object of the Protestants was to thwart the Catholic Duke of York, who married a second time. His new wife being a young lady only 15 years old, the Catholic sister of the Duke of Medina. In this they were seconded by the Protestant dissenters, though to their own disadvantage. Since, to exclude Catholics from power, they were even willing to exclude themselves. The king's object was to pretend to be a Protestant, while he was really a Catholic. To swear to the bishops that he was devoutly attached to the English Church, while he knew he had bargained it away to the King of France, and by cheating and deceiving them, and all who were attached to royalty, to become despotic, and be powerful enough to confess what a rascal he was. Meantime, the King of France, knowing his merry pensioner well, intrigued with the king's opponents in Parliament, as well as with the king and his friends. The fears that the country had of the Catholic religion being restored, if the Duke of York should come to the throne, and the low cunning of the king in pretending to share their alarms, led to some very terrible results. A certain Dr. Tonch, a dull clergyman in the city, fell into the hands of a certain Titus Oates, a most infamous character, who pretended to have acquired among the Jesuits abroad a knowledge of a great plot for the murder of the king, and the re-establishment, if the Catholic religion. Titus Oates, being produced by this unlucky Dr. Tonch, and solemnly examined before the council, contradicted himself in a thousand ways, told the most ridiculous and improbable stories, and implicated Coleman, the secretary of the Duchess of York. Now, although what he charged against Coleman was not true, and although you and I know very well that the real dangerous Catholic plot was that one with the King of France, of which the merry monarch was himself the head, there happened to be found among Coleman's papers some letters in which he did praise the days of bloody Queen Mary and abuse the Protestant religion. This was great good fortune for Titus, as it seemed to confirm him. But better still was in store. Sir Edmund Barry Godfrey, the magistrate who had first examined him, being unexpectedly found dead near Primrose Hill, was confidently believed to have been killed by the Catholics. I think there is no doubt that he had been melancholy mad, and that he killed himself. But he had a great Protestant funeral, and Titus was called the savior of the nation, and received a pension of £1,200 a year. As soon as Oates' wickedness had met with this success, up started another villain, named William Bedloe, who, attracted by a reward of £500 offered for the apprehension of the murderers of Godfrey, came forward and charged two Jesuits, and some other persons with having committed it at the Queen's desire. Oates, going into partnership with this new informer, had the audacity to accuse the poor Queen herself of high treason. Then appeared a third informer, as bad as either of the two, and accused a Catholic banker named Staley of having said that the King was the greatest rogue in the world, which would not have been far from the truth, and that he would kill him with his own hand. This banker, being at once tried and executed, Coleman and two others were tried and executed. Then, a miserable wretch named Prance, a Catholic silversmith, being accused by Bedloe, was tortured into confessing that he had taken part in Godfrey's murder, and into accusing three other men of having committed it. Then, five Jesuits were accused by Oates, Bedloe, and Prance together, and were all found guilty, and executed on the same kind of contradictory and absurd evidence. The Queen's physician and three monks were next put on their trial, but Oates and Bedloe had for the time gone far enough, and these four were acquitted. The public mind, however, was so full of a Catholic plot, and so strong against the Duke of York, that James consented to obey a written order from his brother, and to go with his family to Brussels, provided that his rights should never be sacrificed in his absence to the Duke of Monmouth. The House of Commons, not satisfied with this as the king hoped, passed a bill to exclude the duke from ever succeeding to the throne. In return, the king dissolved the parliament. He had deserted his old favorite, the Duke of Buckingham, who was now in the opposition. To give any sufficient idea of the miseries of Scotland in this merry reign would occupy 100 pages. Because the people would not have bishops, and were resolved to stand by their solemn league and covenant, such cruelties were inflicted upon them as make the blood run cold. Ferocious dragoons galloped through the country, to punish the peasants for deserting the churches. Sons were hanged up at their fathers' doors for refusing to disclose where their fathers were concealed. Wives were tortured to death for not betraying their husbands. People were taken out of their fields and gardens, and shot on the public roads without trial. Lighted matches were tied to the fingers of prisoners, and a most horrible torment called the boot was invented, and constantly applied, which ground and mashed the victim's legs with iron wedges. Witnesses were tortured as well as prisoners. All the prisons were full, all the gibbets were heavy with bodies. Murder and plunder devastated the whole country. In spite of all, the Covenanters were by no means to be dragged into the churches, and persisted in worshipping God as they thought right. A body of ferocious Highlanders, turned upon them from the mountains of their own country, had no greater effect than the English dragoons under Graham of Claverhouse, the most cruel and rapacious of all their enemies, whose name will ever be cursed through the length and breadth of Scotland. Archbishop Sharp had ever aided and abetted all these outrages. But he fell at last, for, when the injuries of the Scottish people were at their height, he was seen, in his coach and six, coming across a moor, by a body of men, headed by one John Balfour, who were waiting for another of their oppressors. Upon this they cried out that heaven had delivered him into their hands, and killed him with many wounds. If ever a man deserved such a death, I think Archbishop Sharp did. It made a great noise directly, and the merry monarch strongly suspected of having goaded the Scottish people on, that he might have an excuse for a greater army than the Parliament were willing to give him, sent down his son, the Duke of Monmouth, as commander-in-chief, with instructions to attack the Scottish rebels, or Whigs as they were called, whenever he came up with them. Marching with 10,000 men from Edinburgh, he found them, in number 4 or 5,000, drawn up at Bothwell Bridge, by the Clyde. They were soon dispersed, and Monmouth showed a more humane character towards them than he had shown towards that member of Parliament whose nose he had caused to be slit with a penknife. But the Duke of Lauderdale was their bitter foe, and sent Claverhouse to finish them. As the Duke of York became more and more unpopular, the Duke of Monmouth became more and more popular. It would have been decent in the latter not to have voted in favor of the renewed bill for the exclusion of James from the throne, but he did so, much to the king's amusement, who used to sit in the House of Lords by the fire, hearing the debates, which he said were as good as a play. The House of Commons passed the bill by a large majority, and it was carried up to the House of Lords by Lord Russell, one of the best of the leaders on the Protestant side. It was rejected there, chiefly because the bishops helped the king to get rid of it, and the fear of Catholic plots revived again. There had been another got up, by a fellow out of Newgate, named Dangerfield, which is more famous than it deserves to be, under the name of the Meal Tub Plot. This jailbird, having been got out of Newgate by a Mrs. Sellier, a Catholic nurse, had turned Catholic himself, and pretended that he knew of a plot among the Presbyterians against the king's life. This was very pleasant to the Duke of York, who hated the Presbyterians, who returned the compliment. He gave Dangerfield 20 guineas, and sent him to the king his brother. But Dangerfield, breaking down altogether in his charge, and being sent back to Newgate, almost astonished the Duke out of his five senses by suddenly swearing that the Catholic nurse had put that false design into his head, and that what he really knew about was a Catholic plot against the king, the evidence of which would be found in some papers, concealed in a meal tub in Mrs. Sellier's house. There they were, of course, for he had put them there himself, and so the tub gave the name to the plot. But the nurse was acquitted on her trial, and it came to nothing. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.